It's an interesting phenomenon that while we are one of the most connected generations of all time, we are also more isolated from those around us. We are more separated from family and friends and God, even ourselves, than any other generation before us. I don't know if this is true, but one article I read this past week argued that for all of our connectedness through our social media of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, the lonely we are actually likely to be. Did I get any likes today? Did anybody comment on my posts? And so-and-so has far more likes than I do, and they're not even as interesting as I am. And well, you get the idea. And I think the reason for this, the reason that we tend to be like this, is that we believe fundamentally that we are alone in the universe and that we are unloved. And our social media only helps reinforce that feeling in us by showing us how happy everybody but us is. It's an illusion, by the way, but that's what they show us, which in turn gives rise to the belief that the individual is the supreme entity in the world. And in this, it gives rise to a sociopathic, narcissistically based belief that only the strong and the powerful can survive. I have to secure everything for myself because nobody else will. And we live in that environment today. We live in that environment today. We see this expressed most clearly in the very casual, disturbingly casual way in which we kill, murder our own citizens. I don't know about you, but when I saw the videos, first of the fella in North Carolina, I believe it was, or South Carolina, who was being shot in the back for lack of child care payments. So his last day on earth, he's going to himself, gee, if I had just made a payment, I wouldn't be shot dead in the back today. And the image was just of a police officer going boom, 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 and walking up very casually to a man that he had just shot in the back. We saw it in Baltimore when the police ganged up on this young man and they broke his neck. And then they put him in the police cruiser. He's screaming for help, and they don't take him to the hospital. How can we condone this? How can we condone this? We have a sick society, and it's all over. It's not just this police department in Baltimore. It's not just that police department in South Carolina. It's not just the Los Angeles Police Department or the New York City Police Department. It is our society that has decided that the only way we can keep control of people is to say that if you sin for any reason, which is breaking the law for any reason, we have a right, society has given you the right, to kill on our behalf. It's outrageous, folks. It is not Christ-like, and nobody in the church should ever defend this. Nobody in the church should ever defend this. We even see it in the length and the level of the churches in our own presbytery. Those of us who are still able to keep our doors open are also watching as certain individuals within the presbytery circle around us, looking at other buildings that are about to close so that we can take their assets and keep ourselves going for a little longer than we would have otherwise, sadly, before we're even dead in many cases. And as much as we might wish this wasn't true, it is. In the church, too often the case that we shoot our wounded rather than care for them. Our lesson from 1 John suggests that we look to a different source to meet our needs, that we stop looking to ourselves as if somehow we have the capacity to do what God does. John calls us to love one another based on the fact that God is love and is the source of love, not ourselves. More than that, John points to the ultimate demonstration of God's love in Jesus the Christ. We call it the incarnation, the belief that in Jesus, God somehow came to walk in our shoes to experience the fullness of our suffering, of our struggles, and even of our loneliness. And through this amazing demonstration of love, John says that we come to know and believe in the love that God has for us. That we come to know and believe in the love that God has for us. Now, I think that the theology of the incarnation is important for us to understand, but I doubt, seriously doubt, that most of us came to know God because of a belief in a doctrine or a belief in a dogma that has been put out by the church. Rather, most of us come to know and to believe in God's love because somebody at some point in our lives loved us. Hopefully it was parents, grandparents, friends, uncles, aunts, whoever. But somehow we came to know about God's amazing love because some other person loved us in our lives. And we have been asked by God to pass that on. That's the commandment. Unfortunately, we often fall short in actually doing this. Even in its earliest days, the church fell short. Even in 1 John, he falls short. John wrote that anybody who doesn't love a brother or sister cannot love God. He writes that. Yet he also goes on to attack those who have separated themselves from his church over doctrinal disagreements. In fact, he condemns them in 1 John chapter 3, the one before this one, as antichrists and children of Satan. Not so loving. But if we're honest with ourselves, which I love about our scriptures because it is so honest about who we are, we have to confess that we have all been there, that we have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We have all fallen short of that command that God has given us. And the sad thing is that when we do this, we retreat behind walls of bitterness. We begin to build up stereotypes because we don't know each other anymore. We don't relate with each other as human beings. We see each other as race, black or white, or we see each other as poor or middle class or rich, but there is no individuality. There is no sense of our common humanity anymore. And the sad thing is that when we retreat behind these walls of bitterness and increasing isolation and separation, we become lonelier, more defensive, more desiring of our own security. And by isolating and separating ourselves from the world of humanity around us, we no longer serve God's purposes. And the world, folks, and this country is crying out so hard right now for somebody to step forward and to start talking about love. Somebody, please start demonstrating that you care. Somebody, please show me that I matter. Somebody, please notice that I've been poor my whole life. Somebody, please help me. The challenge, you see, is that relating to other human beings is a very messy business. It's a very messy proposition, even especially on Facebook, because our relationships get complicated the further we are removed from one another. For example, someone posts something that is innocent enough on Facebook, and everybody turns on that post because they can't see the expression, they don't know what's in the mind, the person hasn't been able to articulate themselves the way they would if they were talking one-on-one, where you could see the expressions, where you could see the gestures, you could hear the tone of voice, you would understand. And because of this lack of human interaction, we have become little islands, pointing fingers. And as long as that crisis, that anxiety doesn't invade my personal space, why should I care about your personal space? Especially if you're doing something that's getting you killed. I don't want to be part of that messy business. I don't want to stand up and be accounted for. I don't want to say that's wrong, because that'll make me unpopular in certain circles. Too bad. Too bad. And that's precisely why God calls us to love each other. Because God is saying to us, that's too bad. Love anyway. God's call for us to love enters us into this messy, complex world of flawed people and to live as witnesses to God's love for each and every one of them. That's what we're called to do. Not to give lip service to the justifications, not to prop up the social structures and say that, you know, well, but this was the reason and that was the reason, and just diminish the basic outrage that we normally feel and should feel at the taking of a human life. It is an experience, folks, first, and a doctrine second. It is an experience first, love is, and a doctrine second. Doing the work you're best at doing and that you like doing is an expression of love. Hearing great music is a great expression of love. Having great fun with other human beings is an expression of God's grace. Something very beautiful that opens your world up. Weeping at somebody else's tragedies in life, feeling their pain, sharing in their triumphs and in their joys. This is all related to the experience of salvation here on earth. It's what it means when Jesus says the kingdom of God is at hand right now. Because in all of these things, two things happen. One, you lose yourself when you love another person. You get out of yourself. And the second thing is that you find yourself. You find that you are most fully who you are by getting out of yourself and by loving another. There is no joy that which love can give you or bring into your life. If you want joy, you must love. That's the ticket. A closer analogy is this experience that we talk about in terms of what love is like. When you love somebody, it is no longer yourself who is the center of your own universe, is it? No, you're constantly thinking, what can I do to make this other person's day better or happier? How can I express my love for them most fully? What can I do to make this a beautiful day? You forget yourself. You deny yourself. You do everything that Jesus did when you love somebody. Now, we do this naturally, but God is calling us to do that natural thing in an unnatural way. Extend it beyond those that you know. Extend it to those you don't know, because they're just friends in waiting. They're not enemies. They're just friends in waiting. You give of yourself so that by the rules of arithmetic, logic should be less of yourself than there should be when you started. In other words, you subtract from yourself. And only by the curious paradox do you get more. But that's the way life is. You lose yourself, Jesus says, so that you will gain yourself. You feel that you are last, but you really are first. The experience of salvation involves the same paradox. Jesus put it like this: he who loses his life for my sake, well, they're going to find it. You'll find it when you act like this. You give up your old self-seeking behaviors to love somebody, and thereby you become yourself at long last. In his book, Beyond Words, Frederick Buechner, who's one of my favorite theologians, he's one of us, he's Presbyterian too, writes, "You do not love God so that he will then save you. To love God is to be saved." To love God is to be saved. You do not love God in order to be saved. You love another person, and therefore you love God, and therefore you are saved. Through the act of loving one another, we are saved. You do not love God and live for him so that he will go to heaven. Whatever side of the grave you happen to be talking about, to love God and live for him is heaven, right here, right now. And we sense that too. We know that because when we're in love with one another, in the sense of we lose ourselves with one another, time stands still. It becomes what Tillich calls eternal. It has no past. It has no future. It just grows in its present form to be infinity. It is a gift. It is not an achievement. It is a gift and not an achievement. You make yourself moral. You can do that. Religion can help you do that. You can make yourself religious. Religion can help you do that. But you cannot make yourself love. You cannot make yourself love. We love, John says, because God first loved us. And it's the truth. Who knows how the awareness of God's love first hits people, you know? Not everybody reacts to it the same way. Every person has his own tale to tell about how this occurs, including the person who wouldn't believe in God if you paid him to believe in God. Because that person, for all kinds of human reasons, has been turned off to God, including the person that you might judge as different than yourself. Some moments happen in your life and you say yes to them. Some moments happen in your life and you say yes, and suddenly it makes sense why you are here on this earth. You laugh with somebody till the tears run down your cheeks, and that's a slice of heaven. You cry with somebody until you find yourselves laughing in the face of death. And again, you realize that you are in the space of God's kingdom. And that love is what sustains us. Love expressed through the likes of you and me, that's what sustains us. But it is only possible because of God. And we will not let God go in the public square. We need God more now than we've ever needed God before in the public square. And whether you thank God for such a moment or thank your lucky stars, it is a moment that is trying to open up your whole life for you. And if you turn your back on such a moment, folks, and hurry along to business as usual, you may lose. Patton called it the unforgiving moment. And they come and they go and you never get them again. If you throw your arms, however, around such a moment, it may save your very soul. It may save your very soul. How about that person that you know, whom as far as you can possibly tell has never had such a moment? There are lots of people in churches who have not had such a moment as this. The sore heads, as Frederick Buechner calls it, the slobs of the world, or the ones the world has hopelessly crippled through its own indifference and callousness. Maybe for that person, the moment has to happen. The moment has to happen through you. You may be the moment of salvation in somebody else's life. That's how empowering it is to walk in the light of God. It is a process. It is not an event. You never arrive. It will take you your whole lifetime. Your whole lifetime. But it is the only way, folks, that we're ever going to be saved. And doing what we are currently doing in this country is not working. It is time to wake up, America. It is time to bring God's love back into this nation through self-sacrifice by those who profess to follow Jesus Christ. Amen.